Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm doing one of those cold opens. First, thanking everyone who has been listening, subscribing, telling their friends. Please do it. Anyone who loves wine, who wants to get into wine, who just wants to hear cool stories for people that work super hard and are talented and interesting and all that jazz. I appreciate everyone out there spreading the word. I love doing the podcast, and I love the fact that there is a lot of people listening who really enjoy learning about wine. Or just, you know, enjoying the thrill of what the wine world is all about. All right, now I'm already rambling. So this interview is with Brian Perry, the head wine steward, head somm, beverage manager, wine manager, whatever you want to say, from the National Club. The National Club is a private club in Toronto. I have been a member since 2006. And when I joined, this was at a time when family sold a piece of property, every kid got a tiny bit of money. And at the time, I used mine to join. Because if you joined before you were 35, at the time I was like 30, 31, it was relatively inexpensive to join the National Club. And I kind of wanted to do something different. My background was in sports and broadcasting. And at that time in 06, I was starting to take classes and learn more about wine. And this felt like a great place to just expose myself to this whole other world. Also, this was a world I was totally unfamiliar with, the private club. And to me, I thought it was neat. I'm like, ooh, let's peek behind the curtain and see what's going on there. And I had a friend named Tim who took me there a couple times, and he introduced me to Brian. And through Tim and Brian, those were the main reasons I initially joined. I should also give a shout out to the general manager, Bill Morani, who's been running the club for ages and just created an environment where, even though, yes, it's a private club on Bay Street, the 31-year-old who didn't, you know, I wouldn't say didn't fit in, but the 31-year-old whose job was certainly very different from 99% of the other members there, everyone was very warm and welcoming, from the other members to the employees and the staff. And by the way, this is not meant to be an infomercial for the National Club. It doesn't matter if you join or not join. I just wanted to give you a little bit of a background. But the point is that Brian has been in my life since 2006, in my wine life since then. This was an interview I've been wanting to do for ages, because he's not retired, but he's been there for ages. You'll hear all of this. You know, his time there will be coming to an end in a couple of years. So he'll still be doing stuff on the side. But I really wanted to interview him because he had such a big impact on my wine life. So I was thrilled to have him. This interview is going to be in two parts because we went over an hour. Also, one of the big things, I want to apologize. The sound quality isn't great, especially on Brian's end. It's where I sat him. He was very close to this radiator, so you can hear a little background noise. And also, I should have been more strict with Brian. He was holding the microphone very close to his chest, and I don't blame him. He's not used to holding a mic. In fact, I was happy that he did the interview at all, because he doesn't like talking about himself. He's a very humble guy, even though he's had a massive positive impact on so many members over decades. It's really impressive what he's done, but he's a humble guy. He didn't want to do it. I roped him into it. I basically just bugged him for the last year, so I finally got to sit down. But anyway, I wanted to prepare you ahead of time. The audio quality is, it's not the best. I cleaned it up as well as I could. Thankfully, he's great. You'll learn a bunch. It's a fun interview. So that hopefully will overcompensate for the fact that the audio quality probably needs a little work. Speaking of audio quality, I think this is enough of me. So anyway, here is part one, my interview with the head somm from the National Club, Brian Perry.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And in some ways, this is the easiest interview for me to do. I've known the man for almost 20 years now. It is Brian Perry, the head sommelier of the National Club, a man I consider a friend. Brian, thank you for finally doing this podcast, because I need to say this. If I look at the most influential people in my life for wine, in the top three, you would be there.
Well, that's very kind of you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a lot I want to get into. I want to talk about this club, about you, about your wine journey, but also I want to talk about service, Because I do wonder sometimes where we are right now when it comes to service. And I want to bring up a really quick story, and I've already done too much talking. I'll let you go to it. Doing a Christmas lunch a little while ago, me and my girlfriend Amy, and we decided to get a bottle of Bordeaux to have with our lunch. You came rushing over with the decanter because it needed to be decanted. But this was just a simple lunch, Christmas lunch, and the energy and effort. I remember going to Amy, I'm like, that right there, Brian didn't need to do this, but you did, and you're one of the main reasons why I'm a member here, and this place is so incredible, is because of the service. But when you think of what good service should be at a restaurant or at a private club, what comes to mind for you?
Well, I think from the wine point of view, obviously a little story you told about the decanter is, you know, a no-brainer, considering we were serving at three-year-old St. Emilion.
Yeah.
But regardless of what we're serving, I think in my situation within this club, you know, I was the lone sommelier for a long time. And so the wine program pretty well fell on my lap in the sense of service as well. So you tried to find people around you that at least had consciousness about that level of service. Now there is a much larger flow of wine-trained people in the industry. So it's a less conscious movement to think this way, but for me, it's something that's been drilled into me for absolutely for years. So it was something I would expect if I sat down, so I tried in my job here to always fill that.
What do you look for when it comes, and I'm sure you play a part in this, when it comes to the hiring of staff at the National Club? And by the way, for people listening, I'm sorry if this is going to sound like an infomercial. I do not get paid for this, but there's a reason why I've been a member since 2006 is because the service here has been incredible. The next bad meal is the first bad meal. The next bad experience with a staff member will be the first time that's ever happened. What do you look for when it comes to hiring?
Well, I do very little hiring. So what sort of falls in my lap within my department, that's a little different now. But during my heyday here, it was basically you looked at the waiter that was looking to further their career with wine knowledge and sort of bring them into your fold and help you with your service. But there's something about a club environment, and each generation is different, I assure you of that. But it's I think it comes initially from familiarity with the people you're serving on a daily basis. You know, I worked the restaurant industry, and you know, the mandate was to sell, basically upsell. In this case, you know, you're basically serving people who own the building. So they're always, you know, your guests. Once that sort of epiphany strikes you that you're just not a staff member, that you're a person serving, the people that you're serving are your bosses, you get really good at it, or you hopefully do. In my case, it was people I always sort of chose around me that I thought had an interest in wine and would try to bring them into the fold the best you could and sort of expand their horizons on service with that. But I do say that I think, speaking for most clubs, service is generally quite good.
So the club here, how many bottles? What is sort of, it changes, it fluctuates.
Yeah, but it's fluid.
Yeah.
In its heyday, it was 40,000. That's a number that we ran with for a long time for obvious reasons. But and, you know, many things in my 27 years have happened here to sort of change that. Of course, the largest being COVID, in the sense of having to sell off some of that cellar to keep the lights on and keep the staff and keep the members interested in their membership in the wine program, because, you know, people were paying dues and not being able to come to the building. So for us, we had to sacrifice some of the cellar, not all of it, but had to sell out, do podcasts like yours, do live shows with James Birdie, who was our som at the time, and sell off the wine according to what we were presenting on the show. Each of those weeks turned into months. And so, you know, the plan that we had to initially was maybe a month, maybe 6 weeks. Well, we know what that was.
Yeah.
So that was probably the largest alters in the seller's inventory. We sort of slowed down buying a couple of years prior simply because we were well stocked in many, many things. So it was kind of a comedy of errors from a point of view that we were already on the back of the eight ball by the time COVID hit us. So probably the more accurate number to your initial question is probably 25,000 bottles.
Okay, only 25,000.
It's, you know, it sounds lofty. It's you know, I think personally it's a club should spend their money on this sort of thing. I mean, exclusiveness is a very important thing in the club industry, depending on what your club's about. We're a business club here, so they bring clients primarily. In my early days here, it was a very high-end sort of clientele in the sense of Bordeaux and Burgundy wines only.
Yeah.
So we had to provide a lot of those. So we bought, for instance, in Bordeaux, if we were buying Chateau Palmer, it would be 120 bottles of one particular vintage, 120 bottles of Alter Ego or something else. So those accumulated over the years. as things changed. So there became a pretty good cellar in Bordeaux, to say the least. You know, initially when I started here, I was a bartender here.
Really? By the way, we're going to go there. Yes, I know you don't. I know you. I don't want to talk about you, but we're going to get there. So sorry.
I think it should be a club's mandate to have as much exclusivity, in the cellar as possible, because they can. Most of our members can afford to be anywhere at any time.
Right.
So if they're coming here with clients, the food has to be exceptional, has to be flexible. The menu has to work around their taste, not just what a chef creates. And the wine cellar has to portray that same sort of thing. I think the first lesson for anybody that has to control a wine cellar or a wine program in a club industry is that your own personal tastes are out the window. And that was the biggest lesson in life for me here, let me tell you. So, you know, there was a good budget and you're able to expand the cellar in a lot of ways. And some ways I thought were glaringly obvious to me that we should have at least 500 bottles of Riesling.
Yes.
The truth is we sold 5 bottles a year. And so, when you did sit down with the board or with the GM, who has been amazingly supportive of me for 25 years, would say, well, look, we're building a cellar, but we're not building a library. And, we have to have sales. We have to be able to pay for the cellar. So you obviously make mistakes and you learn from them. But I think it's a thing, what I tried to do mostly through agents, believe it or not, was to find what exclusivity they had that didn't make the liquor board showing, that were in some cases far better than most things, and try to buy it all.
Right.
In the earlier. So we had some exclusives. A glaring example, on Rupert's first South African winery, first move into Canada, I think Vinex may have represented them. I think they did. So we simply said, well, we'll take it off. Because we thought it was exceptional wine. It is still exceptional wine. And pricey. That came with somewhat of a blow from the point of view that you now have to list a South African wine at $225.
Right.
So, those are the risks you take for exclusivity, but they have always paid off for us, bar none. They've always paid off.
And yeah, in this club, when I think about it, certainly Bordeaux is one of, you guys do a lot of things well. I think if I was going to pick one area, the Bordeaux selection here, second to none, and also the price points for it are incredible. It's funny, you could get the same bottle here or 12 feet away from here, and the price would be just, so different. I remember when it used to be the Trump Hotel, trying an overly warm glass of Brunello, that was like $33, and that was like 13, 14 years ago, yeah, versus what you're going to get here.
Yeah.
By the way, yes, it is funny. I would say buy more Riesling, but I'm one of the people that purchase most of
it. I love it too.
Yeah.
But again, it's a thing that just doesn't fit the larger scale here for sure.
I never even thought I was going to go here, and we're getting to you, by the way. I can already hear Amy screaming in my head. Ask Brian about Brian. How important was wine during COVID for the National Club financially? You sort of touched on it.
It was big. Without, mentioning any numbers, it was important for us. Financially, it was incredibly important. We had to keep a core staff with zero income. We had to keep the wine program interesting, people interested in it. So, had to go online and present these things. Then had to get down to that cellar and say, what are we going to do to keep our members contacting us, sending this wine out, sending food with the wine. So it was a kind of a threefold thing for us. It kept our kitchen alive.
Right.
It kept our cellar active. And I think it kept people fairly interested. We lost very little membership. I'm not saying that was a reason. Some people are loyal to this building for whatever reason, but I think it had a lot to do with it.
All right. So how did you come here? How by the way, how long have you been here? People need to know.
27 years.
27 years.
We're not 28.
Yeah.
So initially I came, my background has been a bartender.
Where were you before here?
So I was kind of came through a loop in order to even get here. So I basically did a bunch of things. And then I ended up at the Windsor Arms in the early years in three small rooms. That's a long time ago. From that, I evolved to El Posto restaurant, mm-hmm, when Nell and Piero ran it, the Milano restaurant. And the staff were, I'm going to answer two questions before you ask me the next one. The staff were all Milanos. Mm-hmm. So I was the only Anglo, which they pointed out to me regularly. But they also had taste in wine. And I knew zero about wine. I was basically a bartender, long before mixologist was popular in that title. And so, they had a small cellar, 90% Italian. So I guess my first bite at serving wine, not so much table service, but bringing it to the stewards, was that restaurant. And it was primarily Northern Italian wine. So, there was lots of Barolo on her list. Very little Tuscans because, it's a very geographical thing for them. But so one night I get invited after all extremely good. When I look back on it, these Europeans have a different concept of approaching hospitality than most Canadians do. So anyway, I get invited to the captain's condominium for dinner, and he opened a bottle of, I can remember it, don't remember the vintage, of Brevio Barolo, so the old black tea Barolos.
Right.
And I thought, oh my God, there's the dimensions on this woman. But I didn't understand really. I understood that it was way beyond anything I had probably gone to the liquor store like 85% of the population does and bought something that seemed right from the sense of label. This was an experience. I think, in fact, I can remember we drank probably two of the bottles. And I kind of then had a little bite to say, well, what is this region? I still had no interest in studying wine. I didn't never see what the future would bring me. But I did start to buy a little better. And my initial taste started by that particular evening. Stayed in Italy for a long, long time. When I came here, French wine just overwhelmed me.
So when you started here, you didn't even know like much between Saint-Estèphe versus Margaux.
Ha! So I bartended here. That was a major chore because we were extremely busy club. You know, so I did some wine service, but it was really just from a waiter's point of view, less than a waiter, from a bartender's point of view. So it was basically another beverage. And our system at that time was, the cellar was expansive, but they had one or two armoires, chilled armoires, that all the wines were numbered. And basically it was a numerical system. So you could order a $45 bottle of wine or a $500 bottle of wine. It was basically the number that mattered to any of us at the time.
Right.
So this is going to give a little expansion a little later as to what I had to deal with when I took the job in the wine quarter. But anyway, interesting enough, I served on my own taste, so then I progressed to some Chiantis, to the Absolut Brunellos, which I still sort of favor as one of my favorite wines. And then I think as time went on, I moved into this job, did some bartending, as I told you, and then I decided I'm going to do a wine course. Of course, WSET was the one at that time, that maybe still is. This, now I want to remind you, was 22 years ago.
Yes.
So it was only open to the industry at that time. And I can remember one of our lecturers being Igor, now the MW.
Yeah.
The longtime MW. I can't remember who else was involved. And it was basically, you know, long before being able to go online and study.
So much harder.
So much harder. Tasting so much different from the point of view that it was much more limited. So anyway, that was my sort of bite to... And sort of time evolved, and we sat down together and said, well, we need someone to sort of run our wine program. And, you know, I had the least bit of knowledge to be able to start. So I said, okay, let's try it. Now, I walked downstairs and you know, realized I was looking at, you know, 16,000 bottles of Bordeaux.
How intimidating.
It was incredible.
How for you?
It's still to this day.
Yeah.
But it was incredibly. Because no one ever had any loftiness about it, because Bill had been here for 40 years, was used to it. These were things they were accustomed to. It was the wine in the basement. And little did they know that no basement, other than the Toronto Club and a few other buildings, had that kind of inventory. I myself didn't quite realize what I was looking at, but as I started to realize that I had to, you know, count it, inventory it, list it, figure out when to list it, continue buying it, you know, for the first 3 years were, I was definitely in over my head.
Right.
Almost on a continuous basis. Now, you know, along with that, I had zero clerical background, so I had to balance, count, provide some sort of budgeting to people. So I must tell you, that intimidation was coupled with my inability to sort of back it up with paperwork. So somehow or another, I got through that. And now it seems like it's behind me, but it's still an intimidating thing. You know, the wine program in any place worth its salt, it shouldn't be intimidating, but it should be sometimes eye-opening for sure.
Or at the very least, it's you want to be respectful. You know, you see these wines, these old wines, you want to make sure they're stored properly, they're open properly, they get into the hands and the palates of people that are going to appreciate it. Because you'll look at an old bottle of Palmer, you know the people who made it, you know the soil it came from, and the work and effort and time that goes into it. So it's funny, you know, it was more intimidating before, and now you want to be respectful towards
it. Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, COVID was very hard on me from the point of view of watching things that I had accumulated personally for the members,
right,
go out the window. And I shouldn't say out the window, out the door to the members. But I had sort of hoped I would leave a little deeper of cellar than is being left to, mm-hmm. to my current replacement now. And, you know, consider today, if you, in my time, you bought a Chateau Margaux for $350. And even that was a bit lofty. And in the last 2 years, to replace that Chateau Margaux is now $1,000.
Yeah.
The peril with that, and the peril, I think, with most clubs that have lasted for 40 or 50 or 100 years, in our case, 150, is that people have a knowledge of that list for 20, 25 years. Even in your case, you've been here for 16 or 18 years. So now you buy a current Margot, and you put it on the list for even a moderate markup of $1,800, where for years they came in pretty dear at $600 a bottle. So that's a peril that the future will bring to anyone that's running the program. But even as I'm still a little bit a part of it, I can see that it's been really challenging for Jeremy now, and for anybody that's going to be in the program now that has a deep cellar. In a sense of history.
For people, you know, people like me can be jerks if I go, hey, I used to pay.
And I get it. I kind of get it, because if you don't know the industry, it's wine. And why suddenly is it 300% higher than it was 20 years ago?
By the way, I love the fact that you and I, the first wine we both fell in love with was an old Barolo. Because that was mine as well.
Was it
anyone who listens to the podcast on a regular basis has heard the story. I'll tell it to you off because to say the whole thing, but involved my stepdad Sesto and his group of friends who loved to cook, and it was an old brick orange Barolo that confused and excited me. How different would you say the wine program is now versus when you took over in terms of, you know, the portfolio and just in the areas of that we focus on?
Well, I think, you know, it might be good to mention that, you know, I didn't exactly adopt a wine cellar that was by any way decrepit. It was full of French wines.
Yeah.
But I think the thing that was most noticeable to me, getting back to my preference for Italians at that time, was there was two listings, and they were both Antonottis. There was three American listings, mm-hmm. Love them or hate them, that's what there was. And I can remember one being Silver Oak and the other one being probably Dominus, and I can't remember, and the two Antonori holdings, no Brunello, no Barolo. So it seems strange to me. It's just pretty well what the membership dictated at that time, and probably the buying technique of the people who were involved that time. So I kind of saw it as a bit of a project to at least get deeper into it. And I never, by the way, I have to quickly add, never got any backlash from that, from management or membership. It was a bit of a hard sell. So my first quest was to go into Tuscany and buy the usual suspects. Some Brunello. In those days, I think Altesino, we did for a long time with Argiano. That's an old house. More interestingly, that year I went to Vinitaly, and I was smitten by what little I tasted in Canada, by the modernist. This may or may not haunt what's left of my career, but I was smitten by the whole portfolio of the modernist stable, starting with Gaia and working your way down to Scavino. So Altair and Scavino, Gaia were all present, and they were represented by one particular company at a time in the U.S. called the Degrassi Brothers.
Yep.
And they had that whole portfolio, which was really a bit of a renegade portfolio, considering that most of the growers and the bottlers in that region saw these guys as mavericks.
And we should let the listeners know, for some that don't know, the modernist means more using the smaller French barriques, making wine that maybe a little more fruit forward early on, can be opened within the first 5 to 7 years, not some wine that you got to put away for 25, 30 years. That's aged in giant old botties.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
So we get a meeting with Enrique Scavino. Mm-hmm. And, you know, our pitch was to buy the 04, stellar year, of course, to build a little bit from that stable. Scavino was the most, I should say, the easiest to approach. He was a friend of an agent who has since retired, so got me a seat with him. And I remember, this is something that's worth mentioning, because Enrique may have been at that time in his 50s, a Giorgio Armani kind of character. And I sort of sat down and I explained the club to him and our reasoning for buying the whole portfolio that was supposedly going to go to LCBO. Anyway, long story short, you know, I explained to him that we have a cellar and that we like to have longevity with this style of wine in this cellar. All was good. And, you know, the Italians still don't get the idea of mixed genders in clubs. Even to this day, it's still a rare find. Nobody briefed me on that. So when I'm explaining to Scavino our cellar, and he seems somewhat excited, you know, we're still a young building by European terms, but
yeah,
nonetheless, he was excited. Then I said, oh, you know, we have a woman president. And, you know, this very progressive character said to me, well, why in the world would you have a woman president? Well, the argument was simply, I don't think it was so much chauvinistic. It was basically that they had women clubs and men.
Yeah.
Well, it was a difficult thing to even blend here. So I said, look, you know, we're a business club. I'm making excuses for this venture, but, you know, this is how it operates and this is how it is. Anyway, we did still buy. It wasn't by any stretch a deal maker. It was just a bit of a surprise to me that somebody that progressive was not so. But the interesting part of this subject is that Enrique had two daughters. And now they both won his Rhinery. So
good.
Everything comes around. So anyway, we did buy all of the 04 stable from Scavino at that time, not Gaia, because the prices even then were just outrageous. Also, I think Scavino, Altair, and one other one. That was a big buy for me. It was an $80,000 buy.
Were you nervous?
Extremely.
Yeah.
First of all, I knew it was a style of wine that they weren't familiar with. So it was probably where I did go out on a limb and say, well, I like this wine. I'm going to convince as many people as I can to like this wine.
Well, you were right. Scavino's incredible. No, I know it's easier in 2024, but good on you. It's an incredible wine. It's an iconic Barolo producer. Yeah. They make great stuff.
Yep.
Okay, so when you came in, you know, you wanted to add more Italian to the club that was around. How much Ontario was there then versus now? It's not like we've got a ton right now, but
two houses, probably historic houses, so Chateau Charmin and Esquilin.
Yep.
Were the kind of producers for licensees at that time. There were very few boutique wineries. And to be quite frank with you, I didn't lean a lot towards there.
Nor would you. By the way, sorry to interrupt. Nor would you have back then. I mean,
no.
the leaps and bounds of the quality of wine made in on Prince Edward County or Niagara today versus 20 years ago. It's night and day.
Not even a story.
Yeah.
It's not even a story.
Yeah.
But interesting enough, so that was it. We were sometimes put in a situation like for political events to buy. So our go-to was primarily Enniskillen and Charmes. Mm-hmm. We did ice wine from Enniskillen. They were pretty well the founders of that thing.
Yep.
So we that was our pretty well our, and I have to tell you, I felt like I had so much on my plate to fill in that list with other countries that my own didn't take priority.
I remember early on as a member here, it was a lot of the wine that was being bought. You said this line to me the first time. I've used it 1,000 times. Hopefully I've credited you at least a couple times. That unless a world war was fought on the lands, no one was interested.
That was pretty well how the old boys told me about that.
That's how the old boys...
So there wasn't a war in the country.
Yeah.
You know, their wine wasn't really represented.
How different is that now just with like now younger members?
So there's a not a reversal, but a huge, wider change in tasting wine. And I can't remember the exact date. And it's funny, I remember sitting down with the wine committee prior to you being on it and saying, I can see a big change coming, you know. And we noticed that because in my time, success, first of all, the average age of a successful person that joined the club was 60. So, you know, there are bank presidents or, you know, heads of large law firms. So they already had a seasoned taste in world travel, wine and food. Now you're getting people in tech and, you know, much younger, having good financial success. Now that I have to hastily add does not always buy the glass, but they do have their own taste center. So we started to notice early in the game that when they were coming to close a deal or those sort of things, where basically the wine list, the higher end things started to come to the table. When you're celebrating, in this case, a deal closure, it was Napa Valley. Suddenly it was Napa Valley.
Right.
When I say sudden, in our world it was sudden. It was already happening by leaps and bounds in the real world. But within our close community, it was, what do you mean, an American wine? So, again, we had to sort of run to the racetrack and say, well, who has American wine? What do we do? So it was basically a deed of necessity that we called on Halpern and I originally, who were our Burgundy providers for a long time and still are. And, you know, I think they had a couple of houses I can't remember offhand. And then I think probably my most memorable connection was with Don Bailey.
Yep.
And Don sort of put me on to which were then boutique wineries, Hensel, wineries that have turned out to be absolutely remarkable. But Hensel, you know, the remarkable Tom Eddy, which I'm sure we'll get to later. Then she brought me also Kermit Lynch's stable. So she, as an agent, you know, was a big part in me branching out into wineries that weren't necessarily had that much notoriety with agents or certainly with LCBO. So yes, we noticed a change primarily to American wine, primarily to big Napa wine. I remember buying Dariush from B&W Wines early in the game. We were the first to bring them here. And there was a Cab Franc at 15.1 alcohol. Now, you know, if you're bringing this to any European, he would say, if this is not port, what are we doing?
Yeah.
So, but we sold it like hotcakes. And so it started to indicate to me, you know, not to be bitter about it or not to be, you know, to be any way lofty about it, was that this was a taste that people's palate had developed with, unlike the challenge of Bordeaux's or the challenge of even, you know, good Rhone wines. So we started to realize they were then probably from the beginning of the thought to the end of the 2 years later, year end, they represented 41% of our wine sales.
What time period was this
that
around?
Would have been
roughly, don't have to be the exact year.
Probably 15 years, 14 years ago.
Do you think that we talk about just the change in taste geographically, but then there's also style? As I remember it, in the early 2000s, to say 2005 to 9, 10, it was about big, big, big. And it feels there's been a bit of a swing to more freshness, more acidity, even with like the California Reds. Like you mentioned Tom Eddy, I always appreciated that even his high-end cab would, it had a drinkableness to it. It wasn't just a big
character.
Yeah. It wasn't just a big, heavy bomb coming at me.
For sure. I do see that. I think, you know, even within that new age world, I'm calling it, tastes have evolved to be much more eclectic. There are some things I don't get, but there are some things they do. I think some of the Pinots, you know, Oregon was an enlightenment to all of us in the early years with Ken Wright's production, who I still think is one of the best producers there.
Yep.
But, you know, I remember somebody coming to me, it may have been Tom Bailey, and saying, I've got an Oregon Pinot. I said, well, that's lovely, but, what, you know, I'm already trying to sell these guys modern style Bordeaux. Oh, you need to try this wine. And I have to tell you, it was out of the gate a sure sell for me. Again, a personal decision. Although each of these personal decisions that sound selfish, I knew there was some leverage. I knew there were people I could tap on the shoulder and say, you need to try this wine.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just totally out of the blue. So yeah, there is a bit of a change towards, you know, more a little more fruit direct wine, less sugar content, less alcohol content. I will tell you that the big boys still have a big place in the stable.
Oh, God, yeah.
If you look at wines like Sloan, if you look at wines like Dana, if you look at wines like Stegsleep, you know that Europe and Derioche, 14.6 to 15% alcohol. I don't care how well it's integrated, it's too much alcohol.
I agree. One thing I always appreciate about you, Brian, and this goes back to the conversation about service, is when I joined in 2006, I was like 30, 31 years old. My background was sports broadcasting. I remember the new members lunch. Everyone, a lawyer, a CEO, something, and impressive, really impressive titles. I'm like, I'm Matt. At the time, I worked for a small TV station. It's called The Grill Room. I talk sports. But the one thing I always appreciated about you is that you treated me the exact same way you would have a member of 25 years. I joined the National Club because of you, because my friend Tim Morris, he brought me here, and I love the wine. And I remember exactly what I was saying when you were serving the first couple times and we were chatting about wine. But it's one thing that I appreciated was that there was titans of industry and then there was me, but you treated everyone the same way. And you would be like, hey, Matt, you should try this wine, even though, you know, my buying power would not be nearly as much as someone who's the CEO of a big company. And I think that's been a testament to one of your strengths for, you know, since I've known you.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very kind. But I think most staff here don't really recognize that. In my case, I tend to personalize more because it was wine.
Mm-hmm.
And so you kind of thought, well, is this person this kind of wine drinker, that kind of wine drinker? And not everybody, sadly, is as vocal about it as you are. So it's always, sometimes you have to dig beyond and you sort of get a glimpse of what they're about and that sort of thing. So my idea was just to treat everyone on that level till they gave you reason to.
Right.
Not to. In my whole time here, which is a long time, I have never been talked down to or abused, ever.
Yeah.
So, and I have to tell you, it was one of the most largest things on my scale of reluctance of even coming here. Because, you know, old boys clubs are old boys clubs. And, you know, my real reason to swing back to that for a moment is that I was working bartender's jobs till 2 in the morning, and my relationships and career were basically Mondays off and everyone else was up and you were going to bed. You know, you get to a certain age where that just doesn't happen, at least not as well. So I had a family friend that was involved with Mr. Hackenberger, was a manager at the time, and there was an opening, and I came. I came so reluctantly. When I look back on it, I have to tell you, and every day that I came, not that it whatever gave me any reason for that, I came with the idea of, I'm never going to last here. This is just,
right.
You know, and you know, things happen, things evolve, things grow, but it's been very good. The staff, you know, the staff are family here and they're very good to each other. There's very little sort of animosity. You know, in my case, the management has worked, you know, Bill has worked very closely with me. So I consider him now a friend to me because I've been working with this guy for 25 years and he's had to pay attention to me because I spent his money.
And that's Bill Moran. And you spent it well, Bill Morani, the general manager here. And one testament to the club, and maybe it's easier for me to say just as a white dude, I never felt like it was an old boys club.
That's just a terminology.
Yeah. No, but like you'll get people, oh, you're part of a private club. What's it called? It's called the National Club. And you would see it on the outside. And I know people like, oh, it must be stuffy. Even in 06, even when I was at the very tender young age of like 30 or 31, I never felt it. Like I always felt comfortable even coming here on my own for lunch at 30, 31 years old after leaving a day where my job was spent making fun of the Maple Leafs. Yeah. Or where I knew I was different from the other clients. But no, this place, I've never felt uncomfortable here.
No, I think the staff have a fair amount of leverage here to be themselves and to interact with members. So it's not it's servers, not servants kind of idea. So I think it makes people feel welcome at almost any time. I'm using that terminology to describe the overall business of private clubs, but this one not so much. It's a business club. They're fairly progressive.
Yeah,
I think extremely progressive within the club circuit. And I think you know it shows in the style of service and the attitude of staff towards members or with members. Mm-hmm. It comes out good for sure.
I remember always fighting with the staff members who would call me sir.
I'm like, that's from old world.
Yeah, that is.
It was difficult because if you were a head of any company in an era, you know, that was basically Mr. Cause. Mm-hmm. And that was only respect. And why that was really ever implicated was that, you know, they were clients.
Yeah. I get it.
In that time, it made sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Now it makes zero sense. Mm-hmm. And so any member under 50 goes, why are you calling me that?
Yeah.
We sort of interacted by saying sir to save it from, which is worse, I think, in some cases. But most people in my case, it's been constant. Why are you calling me that?
Yeah. To me, I was always amused by it. To me, it was a novelty. I'm like, oh, look at that. I've been called Mr. Cause. I'm like, no one calls me that. So to me, I was like, all right, this is kind of cool. That ends part one of my interview with head somm of the National Club, Brian Perry. And yeah, it was cool being called sir. It was a fun novelty, something I wasn't used to at that age or even now. And I always tell the staff, you don't need to call me that. And I don't know the wine. I'll talk more about it in the second part. 2014 single vineyard Chardonnay from Au Bon Clément. And Isabelle Clendenin was my guest. That's from episode 119. Isabelle, one of the people involved, the family of Au Bon Clément. So if you want to check out, that is episode 119. Again, sorry for the sound quality. I hope you were able to pick up most of it. Again, this is one of my most important and favorite interviews because it was someone who had a huge influence on my life. I'm not going to yammer. I'm going to end this right now. This ends part one of my interview with Brian Perry. Part two, you can download it. I'm putting them both up at the same time. I just like to break it up so I don't go over an hour in any of my interviews. Anyway, thanks for listening. Part two next.